Hey, everybody, it's Joe, Leslie, and Gabriel from the Annex. We're hard at work getting started on the spring 2018 season. We got a lot of great guests lined up, and we hope you like what comes out. In the meantime, I thought I'd share some of the fruits of our work during the break. Right now, we're putting out one episode a week, and I'm sure you guys will agree, there's just so much more talent that we could put on air than we have the time to produce. So we're trying to raise some funds to get some help producing so that we can put up more content. And part of that fundraising effort involved recording three pilot episodes of three different podcasts. And today we're going to introduce the first of the three podcasts starring our very own Leslie Hinkson in what is a hilarious and really thought-provoking podcast called The B-Side, which we're going to play momentarily. Before we kick it off, though, Leslie, do you have anything to say about the podcast? Any post-recording reflections? Anything you want to tell the audience before we play this pilot episode?
I mean, only that, you know, like the Annex, lots of fun, you know, a bunch of sociologists getting together, talking about some really serious issues without taking ourselves too seriously while we're doing it. And, you know, we have some laughs, but at the same time, I think we make some very, very important points that hopefully our listeners will actually dig. So,
for the record, I loved it and I laughed out loud. Not to raise expectations right before you, the listener.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with producing it, but I sure enjoyed listening to it. It was great, and I think everybody's going to like it a lot.
Great. I mean, we certainly enjoyed taping it, and we're looking forward to the next podcast. So
if you do like this type of programming and it's something that you'd like to support, maybe you can help us by giving us some feedback either on our show page, it's on the sociocast.org, or give us a bump on your social media, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, or something else.
Oh, yeah. And maybe by writing into, tweeting, or calling The Big Listen with Lauren Ober and plugging either the Annex or the B-Side. Thank you.
So let's kick it off.
Welcome to the B-Side, a podcast that engages thinkers, mostly sociologists, at the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and much more. We're your hosts, Leslie Hinkson and
Corey Fields, B-Side, what?
From Georgetown University. Joining us today are our guests, Gene Beeman from Purdue University and Rashawn Ray from the University of Maryland. Gene is the author most recently of Citizen Outsider, Children of North African Immigrants in France from the University of California Press. Rashawn Ray is co-editor of Context, a quarterly magazine about society and social behavior. He's also the director of the Lab for Applied Social Science Research and has a daily vlog, hashtag Daily Thought. Welcome. Thanks for coming on today, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
When we were talking about doing this thing, we were like, who are we going to have on for the first episode? And Gene Beeman, Rashawn Ray were like the first that came up. Not just because we know you guys and we figured you'd say yes, but totally. We're just like, no, these are the people we want. So, yeah, it should be exciting.
No, for sure. So, guys, before we move on, we wanted to talk a little bit about our name, the B-Side. Where does it come from, right? What do you think? I mean, most obviously, the B stands for, you know, Black, right?
That was supposed to be the punchline.
I'm sorry. You know I'm no good at telling jokes, Corey. All right. But also, I mean, in many ways, we are a spinoff of the Annex, the podcast for sociologists. And, you know, in the music world, you know, way back in the day, artists would release a single on the A side that was supposed to be the hit. And then the B side, which was the secondary recording, not to be confused for the lesser recording, because quite often that B side would end up actually being more of a keeper than the A. And I think that's the way we like to think of ourselves.
We're about those deep cuts, you know. Exactly. Everybody's about those radio hits, but we're like, nah, nah, nah. Mm-hmm. We're not even on the album track. It's on like the single B side. Yeah. That deep.
Yeah. So as such, each episode will feature some of our favorite B-side recordings. And so this episode, our favorite Prince B-sides. So, so yeah. So that being said, what are we thinking about today? Corey, do you want to start us off?
I mean, I feel like, you know, as much as I want to caution against, you know, sort of doing what everybody, talking about what everybody else is talking about, there's something so big, I feel like I want to know what you all think. And I know I got my bumper sticker ready. I just wonder, do y'all got y'all Oprah 2020 materials pulled together? So I'm sure we've all seen the footage from the Golden Globe acceptance speech for the, what was it, Cecil B. DeMille Award, which yes. I guess she was the first Black woman to get it in like 75 years or something. And so it was a rousing speech, rousing oratory, which, you know, nobody is surprised by from Oprah. It's what we expect. But I guess I wasn't quite expecting the immediate, like, oh my God, Oprah should run for president. And then even less, I guess I was expecting the relatively aggressive backlash to it. I mean, I guess when it first happened, I was like, oh, this is just almost like a catharsis, collective catharsis kind of thing. No one's really serious about it. But then it felt like a lot of the responses were like very like, Oprah shouldn't be president. Here's all the crazy stuff she's done, blah, blah, blah. And I was just kind of a little bit taken aback by that. So I was just curious what you guys thought on the Oprah for president train.
Well, I mean, I'll jump in. So I have two things. So just in terms of the enthusiasm, right? I mean, I guess I wasn't that surprised given that Black women just saved the Alabama election, right? Mm. And so I was like, yet again, calling a Black woman to save the day and then forget that she did it, number one. And then I guess the second is, you know, I find it really interesting that people are so quick to say these are all of the reasons why Oprah shouldn't run for president. Because one of the reasons they didn't list for her not running for president was that she grabbed somebody by the you-know-what. So
that is true. No one accused Oprah of sexual.
Not yet, at least.
Not yet.
Who knows what could come out. Yeah.
They drop it every day. So yeah. Oprah.
Oh, my God.
I'm waiting on Stedman's story.
Jean, Rashawn, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually had a similar thought about this sort of narrative of Black women having to save all of us. And that's one being a really troubling narrative. And also just because I feel like whenever there's like a sort of shit show to speak of, we rely on a Black woman to kind of save the rest of us. And so I think when I first heard about this, all I could do was sort of like roll my eyes at the fact that, of course, she's the person that has to do this for everyone.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely interesting that the narrative about Black women continuing to save humanity in many regards. And I think historically, Black women have always done that, but with none of the credit. And that's the other part of the narrative, is that Oprah potentially represents not just this savior that, or this super Black woman syndrome, as public health scholars would talk about, but also the fact that she could be visible, right? And the fact that she, up to this point, even though it's just been like a week, she has avoided some of the negative connotations that came attached to Michelle Obama that weren't necessarily initially attached to Barack Obama. Personally, I'm excited. I mean, as a native Tennessean, the fact that I grew up in Tennessee, I mean, just being a Southerner, that gets me excited. But I also think the rallying behind Oprah also speaks to a broader narrative that actually links her with Trump and Bernie Sanders, which is the fact that they are considered outsiders, which is pretty interesting about Bernie Sanders because he's been there for a long time. But his rhetoric and what he kind of stands for has always been outside of that. And I think what it speaks to is that people want more diversity in terms of their politics. I surveyed my class. I taught two large classes. I had 300 students in the fall. And they mimicked what we know about young adults more broadly, that when you look at their voting patterns for the 2016 election, they were split across all four of the major parties, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and Libertarians. And I think Oprah, similar to what Trump represented, similar to what Bernie Sanders represented, as people switched from Obama to Sanders to Trump, they represent something outside of the status quo. And I think that's also something that gets people excited.
Yeah, it's funny because I was like, with the initial election of Trump, and everyone was sort of like, whoa, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And then that quickly sort of deteriorated to like, oh my God, this is what's happening. I was joking. I was joking with a friend of like, sort of what happens post Trump. And I had this like vision where it's like, okay, well, maybe what will happen is Congress will just be like, okay, this country is broken and we need to fix ourselves, but so we're just gonna like, you know, not push forward anything Trump wants to do and just kind of run maintenance on the government, right? Like, let's everybody agree, go to our respective corners and be like, let's just tread water until we can get somebody else in here. But who is the somebody else? And I was like, maybe it should be Oprah. Like, Oprah can bring us together. Like, not because she's a magical Black woman, but like, she has like a lot of experience on that show of getting people to talk about what's going on and cut to the deep, you know, real underlying emotions and feelings. And so I think maybe that's, you know, not the worst idea. Like, a President Oprah who like helps us heal some fundamental wounds so that we can then get to the business of governing.
I don't know. One of the things that I find very interesting about Oprah Winfrey is the fact that she is world famous and world loved, right? In a way that that is at once unbelievable and also slightly scary. I had absolutely no idea that one person was so universally loved around
but
the world.
But how global is she? Because actually, you know what, the one international story I can think of with Oprah is that one where she was trying to shop in France and they called her.
Yeah, well, that's because she wasn't on the TV. She wasn't on the TV screen at the time, Corey.
Right. Part of me thinks, part of this makes me think that she canceled her show at least a decade too soon, because clearly there's still an audience.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Like, the whole own thing isn't really paying off the way I think people thought it would. So, you know.
Although I think she just sold it to somebody. So,
oh, really?
It's paying off for, it's paying off for her. Yeah, I think part of, like, a big chunk of it or something.
Really?
You know, Oprah goes stay paid. So,
well, I mean, one thing about OWN, though, I mean, is that there are definitely some shows that are really powerful in terms of Black representation and really represent the B side. And I think,
yes, for sure.
Couldn't do on her daytime talk show that she can now do. I think Oprah is also in a position, and I think this is one thing she's done, is to put other people on. She's mm-hmm. helped space for other people. And I think that's something that she's wanted to do. So while I agree, I mean, I think she had a good additional run of her talk show and I think this is the thing, could easily come back to that. I think if you have another talk show and people will come back.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, she felt that the OWN network was something she should do. And I mean, I think there are shows on that network that are extremely powerful and important for kind of representing Black folks.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. So in some ways, it's interesting because it's I don't know, what I like about it is the range of representation, both within some specific shows, but also across shows. So it's the kind of thing where like I get less annoyed by like some shows that, you know, if I saw them on, I don't know, the WB or on Fox, I'd be like, why is this always got to be the image of us? Because it's like coupled with, you know, different kinds of representations. I think the compelling thing about what they're doing over at OWN is, I don't know, the sort of range, I guess, if you will, the rainbow of the Black experience that comes through. But it seems like, I'm sure there is a heavy Black audience, but it seems like it's meant to appeal to a wide range of people, to tell Black stories to a wide range of people. So I don't know. I mean, I'm no Oprah, I guess probably I sound like an Oprah stan, but I'm not really. But I don't know. I thought it was an interesting story, and it seemed like it was kind of a media whiplash kind of thing. So we'll see, though. Well, she might sneak up on it.
One other thing I just wanted to add about this actual speech in the Golden Globes I thought was really interesting is that the actual speech, I feel like, she doesn't really talk about her being a leader. She actually talks about the need for each of us as individuals to find our own voice. Right. So it was always really interesting to me that, like, it's sort of the takeaway from that was like, oh, she should be our president. And she actually was saying everyone has their own story to tell, including these working class people that no one ever talks to. So,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, I thought that was kind of weird. So
yeah. I mean, because that's in that no one really, the content of the speech seems to have fallen by the wayside, which is a tragedy.
Yeah. Well, I think that provides a great segue from, you know, possible, you know, 2020 presidential run, you know, from that to our narcissist in chief.
Speaking of tragedy.
And some very unpresidential language, or should I say alleged language, by 45 or Lord Voldemort or he who shall not be named, all the many names that have, that he has been tagged by. But whatever
you... For our listeners, she's talking about President Trump. Am I the only person on the podcast saying Trump today?
No, I was going to say, whatever you call him, Donald Trump basically unleashed a shitstorm by referring to African countries, allegedly, as...
Wait, was that shit house you said, or shit hole? Like, I feel like we have to keep this straight for the reporters.
Well, it came out as shit holes, right? So, you know, that along with his comments about Haiti and his stated preference for immigrants from Norway led many to label Trump a racist. And this particular conversation has taken up a lot of airspace, right? And so just to be sure, just to be clear, today I actually don't want to have a conversation about whether Trump is a racist. This is the B-side after all. What I'm interested in is what the conversation surrounding his comments tells us about the use of the words racist and racism in the United States and around the world, especially as international leaders have been chiming in. So what do you all think?
I'm stunned at the that we're actually talking about, you know, the difference between a shithole and a shit house. As if, what is it that has gotten people so riled up? Is it the content of what he's saying, or is it the fact that he's saying it in an indelicate way? Because the notion, you know, it's not, this is, as someone who studied the right in the U.S., like, this isn't a new idea. Like, nothing he's saying, he manufactured whole cloth out of nowhere, right? But it seems like there's a lot of sort of hair pulling about it. So I don't know. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly a sight to behold.
I'm struck by that as well. I mean, especially because I think, just thinking about the sort of international response, I think in France, it's always interesting because I think, well, you know, this is a country that's colonized several African nations. So ostensibly they think the same thing, but we don't like have the same, like there's not the same controversy, you know? So it's like something about the actual term that's like throwing people off rather than the actual action behind the term.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's like we're okay with the fact of knowing that people think it. And even that people act upon it. I mean, as Gene is talking about, whether it be colonization or, you know, slavery and these sorts of things. But when people outright say it, then all of a sudden we have a problem with it. And I think part of the issue is that in the 21st century, the United States in particular, and I think we could also go to Europe and other parts of the world, are grappling with its social norms and its cultural norms. And Trump is a direct affront to the progress that certain countries and certain societies want to make. But at the same time, it also reveals a lot about people and a lot about our country in terms of when you look at white folks, they're sitting at dinner tables or at family reunions and get-togethers with people who say those same things and who are okay with everything that Trump is doing. And so I think when we really look at who the outrage is coming from, I mean, yeah, of course, black and brown people are unnerved and annoyed and frustrated, of course, realize that he's a straight up bigot, a racist and a sexist and all these other things. But of course, that's not new to us. For as Corey was saying with his work, I mean, when we look at people who align with the alt-right or white supremacy and even some conservatives who have extremely, extremely prejudicial views of black and brown people, then the main group that has a problem with this are white liberals. White liberals who are living in these bubbles who think that for whatever reason that the world is not this way, that they've been able to craft out a society where they can not only not have to pay attention to black and brown poverty, but they also haven't necessarily had to pay attention to people who are on their far right. That's something they thought that didn't necessarily exist in the way that it did. And so when we really look at when we really look on TV as an example about who's outraged, it kind of shows us a lot about where people are in different spaces in society.
So what does it take to be labeled a racist then in America today and have people actually believe that you're a racist? I mean, so so part of the conversation seems to be, well, if you say these things out loud, then you must totally be a racist. But I kind of feel like Trump has inoculated himself against that by just calling all sort of any kind of pushback he gets from what he says as just being just straight up political correctness.
And part of me also wonders, though, to what extent allowing the question to get framed this way, like, is he not a racist? Who is a racist? How do you know a racist? Really does just work to reinforce this notion that, you know, racism is something that exists at the individual level, that it's like something you are, and that it's dichotomous, right? That you are, you aren't. And you know, the good people aren't, the bad people are. And what we need to do is suss out those bad people. And what that distracts us from is, you know, as we all know, the way these things work, they don't need the functioning of bad people in back rooms with cigars and swastikas, right? Like, it actually works best without that.
Yes, except
that.
In this instance, Corey, you actually have the leader of the most powerful country in the world, right?
Who gets to sit in the back room with a swastika, right? So
this is actually sort of like probably the one example where I think I might be like, yeah, sometimes at the individual level, it actually might, you know.
But so what's interesting though is that, like, I don't have any illusions that there's some sort of master plan coming from, you know, the White House around any of this stuff. But it wouldn't surprise me that, like, these kinds of conversations really do distract from, you know, consideration of, like, broader structural problems. Not saying that we shouldn't have them, but I do think in a lot of ways, it's easy enough for us to get caught up in this conversation. And all the while, it's like, you know, the DACA program is about to expire. And it's like, those two things are certainly linked, right? Like, and I don't think it's a coincidence, but I do wonder if, like, that might be a better launching point for a conversation about, you know, the racism present in, you know, the president, but also within social policy, as opposed to, you know, I don't know, like, indelicate or, you know, language, or, you know, him saying shithouse or shithole. He said shithole. I feel like he said shithole. We should, like, keep, that's what he said, despite what some Republican senators would have us believe. I don't know. It's, yeah, but I mean, obviously there's enough room to have all these conversations. And maybe that's what's most distressing, is that, you know, it feels like we've been set back in some ways.
I mean, one thing I think is actually interesting, though, about the actual Republican denial of him saying that is that no one follows it up with, like, he would never say that because he thinks A, B, and C. It's like, he clearly thinks that. He just didn't actually say that. Like, that's like the weirdest defense I've ever heard of someone.
No, he would totally say it. He just didn't say it.
Like, he just didn't say it this moment. But he, you know, like, it's like, because you can't point to anything that would suggest that he doesn't think that. So it's like, it's a bizarre conversation.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been amazed at how America takes what wealthy white men say as the Bible. I mean, so like, Trump does all this stuff, and then he comes out and he's like, I'm the least racist person you know. And people are like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, he said it. He's the least racist person he knows. I mean, so it always baffles me how much we believe people. And it's two things that I kind of think about. First is that on one level, our tolerance for racism is so high that when people actually engage in racism, it's so normalized that we don't even think it's a problem. So in order to be considered racist, in order to actually be doing something racist, it has to be so explicit in terms of not just that this was prejudicial in their thinking, but also that it was racial in their act, in the discrimination that they were actually administering to someone else. And it makes me think of a quote, since, you know, we talk about social media and all this stuff. It's something I've seen on social media that said, racism is so American that when we protest racism, the average American assumes we're protesting America. And right. I think that that is so telling, because we live in a society where it's not just about colorblindness anymore. It's about being post-racial. So the thought is that if you bring it up, then all of a sudden you're the person who's racist.
And in some ways, yeah, I think this is, you know, a strong, like, political tension in the country, right? Because I think there are people, you know, I would count myself among them, who want to push for, like, look, racism isn't just burning a cross in my front yard. Don't do that either. But I also want, like, to talk about, you know, residential segregation. I want to talk about, like, police brutality, right? Like, I want to talk about, like, practices that extend beyond, you know, I don't want to say, like, basic, but it's almost like a Maslow hierarchy of needs, right? Where there's, like, a really strong contingent of folks in this country who are like, look, as long as people aren't burning a cross in your front yard, or your boss isn't being like, nigga, go get my coffee, like, what else can you expect? And I think, you know, the challenge, or, like, a real source of tension, is, like, not letting that become our bare minimum. And for me, in a lot of ways, like, the troubling thing about what's happening with political discourse, and certainly discourse around race, and embodied in a lot of the stuff that Trump will say, is you really do feel like you're working very hard to not actually, to get to a scenario where the president isn't being like, Africa's a bunch of shithole countries. It's like, wait, we have to do that work again? And actually, thinking of quotes, it's like that Toni Morrison quote that you see always over social media about, like, what racism's job is to do is to distract you, right? And it's, like, not just distracting, but sort of pushing back. It's been strange, because I grew up in the South too, Rashad, in Tennessee, actually. And we always used to joke about, like, oh, well, yeah, I think we have talked about this before. And but it's like, you know, I'd rather know who's racist than, you know, not know.
Oh, so, right. Like, you know. Yeah, we have talked about this, about, like, where people, you know, I want to know if somebody's going to stab me in the back. Like, I don't want to stab me in the front, you know. And you go to the North and people, like, might stab you in the back. And
you have no idea.
You have no idea. In the South, they just call you boy and let you know where you stand. Boy, you're in the wrong place, you know. And so, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that with Trump, he represents what a lot of people think. Because the other part we got to think about here with racial attitudes is that it's a large percentage of white folks who now feel like they're being racially discriminated against.
Right.
So it's not just about the fact that black people are getting treated poorly, or brown people are being treated poorly. White people feel that they are being treated poorly because of race. Even if they are conflating race with class and ageism and other things, they assume that it's race. But also, you mentioned about the individual level, people can't see structure. It's difficult for people to see policy. So they really don't realize the impact that structure and policy has on their lives. All they see is their immediate surroundings. And because of that, have a very overly simplistic view of what racism is. And I think that part of that is our duty as sociologists and social scientists, is to help people to be able to better understand that racism functions on multiple levels, not just on an individual level.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, and that gets me thinking about the effects of structures. Like, we can't see them, but very, very often, like, those impacts do get actually embodied, right, in individuals. And that makes me actually think about, so a group of my students were working together on a project on racial disparities in maternal mortality, right? And then a week after that, NPR had a story on the very same thing. And, you know, the story and also the reality simultaneously breaks my heart and also makes me so angry. So very angry. And I actually think that thinking about these huge racial disparities in maternal mortality, like, is a way of saying, hey, let's look at the very, very real ways that, like, racism as, you know, as this structural concept, not this, you know, racial attitude and, you know, and potty language. right? Works to actually undermine our materiality, right, as a people, right? And so, Rashaan, given your work on health disparities, what can you tell us about maternal mortality and race in America?
Geez, there's so many things running through my head. I mean, the thing that pops up immediately is Serena Williams. So, I mean, here you have, I think without a doubt, one of the top five, I just put these random numbers on things, top five best athletes ever in the world, and delivers this baby. And she's wealthy right on top of that. Mm-hmm. She tells the medical staff that she thinks something is wrong, that they need to run additional tests. And she's dismissed. And I think when we look at the medical system, one of the ways that racism permeates the medical system is related to benign neglect. There was another study that just came out a couple of days ago, actually showing that Black babies are given less steroids after they've been born to help them kind of deal with coming into the world. I mean, we could think about the ramifications of this, right? And some of the cutting edge work that's been going on centered around epigenetics, the way that our environment ends up manipulating and changing our physiology is something that we really don't have a really good handle on, even though we know these sort of things are going on. And I think one key thing, there's a key study that I always highlight, which had Black and white people to say what their pain threshold was from 1 to 10. So say everyone on here said that our pain was a 9, and then say our white colleagues also said that their pain was a 9. Well, individuals gave us less pain medication. And the reason why that is so telling is we think about birthing a baby. When I watched my wife go through that process, and I think about the fact that she would not be getting the pain medication that she deserves. And then I think about the impact that has on the baby, the stress that puts on the mother in terms of the heart rate, the stress that happens when a baby is being born. And collectively, we start to see just that intimate moment start to be something that really has ramifications for maternal mortality, child mortality. I mean, we haven't even got to what happens before they actually get to the delivery room, those 10 months before, those 40 weeks before leading up to the process and the way that benign neglect operates. But we see this happen regardless of whether or not Black women are affluent, less affluent, have a lot of education or not. My wife is a nurse practitioner. One of my best friends, he is a radiologist. And these incidents happen to our wives, even though our families are wrapped up in the medical system. And so we see the way that racism really starts to impact maternal health. And it's something that people really don't pay attention to that can really impact life chances and outcomes.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's incredibly, incredibly, incredibly well said. I mean, I think, you know, in thinking about the whole maternal mortality figures, right? I mean, for me, as I said, I thought that it was, I think, just a very horrific way of thinking about the ways in which racism gets embedded, not just in the body of the woman, right? As she's struggling to make sure that this life or these lives inside of her, right, make it, right? You know, with my little ones, I'd always be like, okay, just hang on, little tomato, just hang on, little tomato. And, you know, and this idea that it is a struggle, right? It is a struggle, right? Mm-hmm. And that then gets passed on during those 40 weeks, right? To that fetus, right? Who then, you know, grows into this viable life, right? Who then grows into this infant, right? And that to me, I was like, this is the beginning. It like our very lives are in many ways threatened from the very beginning from this thing called racism.
I mean, without a doubt. I mean, you know, what you just talked about, like one of the things that's difficult for us to capture is stress. I mean, the way that stress impacts our bodies. And then we think about the fact that women are carrying another person inside of them and the way that stress manifests itself. It's like one of the other studies that's interesting to me is it was a study looking at Black kids finding that their telomeres were shorter. So telomeres essentially, I mean, it tells you a lot of things, but one of the things it tells you is how long they might live. And they found that for Black youth living in impoverished communities, Black children, not even youth being like teenagers, Black children, that their telomeres are the length of individuals who are in their 30s, 40s, I mean, are the size of individuals who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Because that is what stress ends up doing to people. That is what living in an impoverished community and dealing with racialization and structural racism does to people. And it's something that we simply haven't studied enough.
Well, thinking about stress, so one of the hypotheses behind why not only do we see these racial disparities in maternal mortality, but also in low birth weight among infants is this idea of weathering that Geronimus came up with, you know, decades ago, right? Which in some ways seems counterintuitive. I mean, I don't know about y'all, but, you know, I always thought, you know, Black don't crack, right? So, right?
Like yeah, internally right? too, I guess. Yeah.
right?
Maybe it's, yeah, it's like a playoff of each other, like to maintain. I mean, because I guess the efforts at maintaining the non-cracking probably takes right. their own toll.
Oh, man. And that's the thing. You know, I tell, like, you know, this comes up a lot in class. Of course, as you all know, you teach race and these other types of courses and people like Black people look great. They live forever, you know, so because part of it is not just the negative consequences of being Black. And we know how that relates to intellect. But there are a lot of people, including Black folks, who buy into all of the notions about Black physicality. Yep. Right.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So part of
I hear that from students all the time.
Our bodies. And the fact that our skin, and I always tell people, I'm like, well, first off, I think a lot of that has to do with people's exposure to the sun, right? I mean, I see Black, brown people all the time, Asians, Latinos, Blacks walking around with hats on, with umbrellas, just trying not to get in the sun because we already know that skin tone has implications for our life chances. But internally, even beyond that, internally, so even if a person supposedly looks good externally, that doesn't mean internally. We don't see a host of health consequences and health problems. And we know that Black people face all of an assortment of comorbidities that lead to them having higher blood pressure, hypertension, cardiovascular disease. So when I hear people say, you know, oh yeah, Black don't crack, I'm like, yeah, but Black people showing up dying. So you know, I would rather look like crap and live to be 100 than look
like
crap and die
60. Right.
You know,
that's a question for the ages, Rashawn. That's a question for the air.
I'm like,
I don't know. I'm like,
you know, like this is how. Look, on one hand, you know, because this is the other part. There are some Black folks that live in certain communities who don't expect to live a long time,
right?
Of course, we could talk about that. But then on the other hand, there are individuals who do. And so when I think about this, I think about my uncle who was living in Atlanta. And he was 16 years older than me, and he passed away at 49. He was working 2 full-time jobs, had a stroke at work, just working so hard, dealing with the stress of life, dealing with different types of experiences that he dealt with. He looked wonderful. He looked like, we looked like we were brothers.
Right. But
at the same time, I mean, when you don't live to be 50 in this era, I mean, we're talking about huge problems, huge structural problems that people can't necessarily see. That starts to, you know, come out in the water we drink. So Leslie, you know, you're talking about what happens during the process. I mean, the water we drink, the food that we eat, what we have access to, all of this impacts maternal health. It influences infant mortality. And I mean, and it leads to huge racial differences.
And I guess on that down note.
Oprah, save us!
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Please, Oprah, I don't want to die at work.
Yeah, you got me on a rant, but let me tell you, let me try to end on a positive note. So there's a study finding that about 50% of all of the Black mothers who die during birth, that these can be prevented if we reduce some of the biases in the healthcare process leading from pregnancy to delivery and also change some of the policies. So I think it's a lot of work to do. I mean, there are pathways for us to change some of these outcomes that we see. And I think we just have to think strategically about how to do it.
And that's an important point. And I think, you know, and then that's the kind of, I think, fact you hear where it's like, that should be an unassailable point. Like, no one should rest comfortably in a country where it's like, look, we can actually do something to prevent half of these deaths. It shouldn't, the question shouldn't be, you know, will we or won't we? It should be like, how quickly are we going to do it? So
I think that's a great point.
We'll see.
Okay.
The Oprah regime will be different.
So you're all in on Oprah?
No, not really. I just think it's fun to pretend to be all in on it, especially because, like, you know, my super smart political friends, it annoys them to no end. So I think that's going to be like my performative thing now. It's like Oprah 2020.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys for joining us. This has been awesome, an awesome kickoff to the B-side. Had a good time. And before we get out of here, is there anything we should know about what's going on with you two? Jean, Rashawn, what's up?
Well, I would like to make a point about maybe the last piece we just talked about.
Yeah.
Only because the NPR piece on maternal mortality among Black women actually features a woman who got her PhD in sociology at Purdue, before I came here. So I thought it was also interesting to think about the sort of collateral consequences of the work that we do as well, and to keep that in mind.
Yes, Jean. I didn't want to go there. No. But I think it's actually a very great point. I think that I don't know about your mentors, Jean, but I know that many of my mentors cautioned against having children before tenure, right? And I wonder how much of that, I mean, I think the way that it was generally spun was that, it's just going to be incredibly hard for you to get your work done, mm-hmm. right? Although I didn't hear anybody cautioning the men not to have children. So I wonder how much of it is, unbeknownst to them, there was this sort of quote unquote protection right. they were trying to afford us, knowing very well, you know, the amount of stress that the whole sort of like grad school job market tenure publishing processes puts on a body, especially in a field where, you know, we still have a way to go in terms of gender parity. So,
yeah, no, I think it's a really crucial question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yet again, Jean being brilliant and observant.
Jean, I didn't know did you have anything else you wanted to say about what you're doing and stuff?
Oh yeah, I can talk about what I'm currently studying. Yeah, if you want, So now I'm, my book came out, A Citizen Outsider, on children of North African immigrants in France, and specifically the middle class segment and how they deal with or understand racism in France. So now I'm sort of building off of that to study police violence in France and how activists mobilize or attempt to mobilize against police violence that disproportionately targets Black and North African origin individuals in a society that doesn't acknowledge that race is, you know, exists or is legitimate. So how do people sort of mobilize against a race-related issue in a context in which you can't acknowledge race? So that's what I'm currently up to these days.
Nice.
And Rashawn, what about awesome. You?
The big thing I'm working on, similar to Jean, we have a large study with police departments actually examining the impact that bias-free training has on changing police behavior and police attitudes. And so we've developed virtual reality scenarios and simulations that allows us to actually examine police officers' physiological makeup, so their heart rate, their stress level, their body movements, mm-hmm. to figure out what impact different types of people have on kind of changing those things. So in other words, if a police officer sees Corey or myself, does their heart rate instantly go up? Does their stress level change? And does that potentially have an impact in how they might treat us and lead to implicit biases coming out even more?
Those are both great projects.
And you guys are both on Twitter, right? If folks want to get in touch and hit you up to find out more about all this stuff, right?
Yeah, my handle is Jean23Bean.
Yeah, mine is Sociologist Ray.
All right. Well, thank you. You've been listening to The B-Side, a sociology podcast on the cutting edge of thought on Black culture, politics, and materiality. Thanks to our inaugural guests, Jean Beeman from Purdue University and Rashawn Ray from the University of Maryland, for a great conversation. We're your hosts, Leslie Hinkson and
Corey Fields
from Georgetown. So to take us out, here's another of our favorite Prince B-sides. Until next time.
Oh. I've been looking.